Edward O. Wilson is currently University Research Professor Emeritus and Honorary Curator in Entomology of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University. He is the author of 25 books, two of which won Pulitzer Prizes, Human Nature in 1978, and the celebrated The Ants, done with Bert Holdobler. And he is one of the most celebrated scientists of our time, and it is really a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Wilson to the Allegheny Front. Welcome, sir.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Is it hard to sit through when people read off such a great resume?
I squirm a little bit, although certainly not going to engage in false modesty, but it's easy to get to the point of unendurability if I have a too long an introduction.
Well, I have to say that the paragraph goes on longer and longer, but it certainly shows a life well-lived, and it really is a nice opportunity to have a chance to talk to you. You're in town discussing the legacy of Rachel Carson, and the conference is titled Sustaining the Web of Life in Modern Society. What lessons was Rachel Carson trying to teach us that we still need to learn?
Rachel Carson is best known for her identification of pesticides, and indiscriminate pesticide use in particular, in the erosion of the natural environment and human health. When the book was published, Silent Spring, more than 40 years ago, the public was unaware that this was a risk in their lives. And since the publication of the book, with greater awareness as a result of that book, and a lot of research and considerable spread of knowledge and awareness, we now know that she was not overstating at all, if anything, understating what the risks are of continuing to load the environment with poisons. Mm-hmm. But she had another message as well, which is becoming clear as fundamental, and that was that we just can't go on living like this, folks. We're doing fine. Our health is better, our incomes are up, our energy use continues to climb, and so on. But we've got to find a better way to achieve that, because right now we're achieving it by eating up the environment, using up our resources, running out of water, and generally all around living like a family of drunks who want to assume there is no tomorrow. And we can have it both ways. Rachel Carson and other environmental thinkers have argued, and now an increasing number of even political leaders, we can have it both ways if we get smart about it. Issues like alternative energy and having the right nature reserves in the right places with the right kind of protection and water conservation of a sensible sort. All these add up to things that can be done and done now and would eventually result, if we keep pressing it, in what's called sustainable development. Meaning just that we can continue to develop in the sense of improving income, quality of life, security, and health, but do it in a way so that we stabilize the world. That is, the natural environment doesn't continue to be ruined while we are improving this quality of human life. In other words, we've got to settle down before we wreck the planet. A lot of people feel that can't be done. They're the pessimists. Unfortunately, a lot of people, whom I call the ignorati, just would prefer not to know. In fact, they include some talk show hosts and some of our best-known political leaders, unfortunately, who find that it's to their advantage if they don't talk about it or if people don't know. And the combination of all this means that we're slow to see what is good for us. Some speak about it being, well, better for us short-term to go on living like there's no tomorrow. But it's not true. We would be better off quickly if we could start taking some of these measures. I think switching to sustainable energy is the one almost everybody understands now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there does seem to be a big disconnect on some of the upper levels And you have to wonder what their motivations are, that they're not recognizing the cost-benefit of starting now. You've been very eloquent to bring to bear what some of the economic portions of this debate are, where people say, well, it would just be too expensive to do this. And you've actually been able to argue otherwise.
Oh, yes. The facts argue otherwise. For example, in the case of our national forests, which are unfortunately administered by the Department of Agriculture, and they were put there because at one time it was thought that our national forests should be sources of timber and other resources, you know, like a big farm. It's argued by one side anyway that we have to keep on cutting down our national forests. That's been the policy of the Bush administration in order to get the kind of economic growth and jobs that the country needs out of our forests. Well, it turns out that the forests produce into the tens of billions of dollars a year to the gross domestic product. However, and the last estimate made was in 1997, but I don't think it's changed a lot since, 78% of the yield to the gross domestic product comes from recreation, and only 14% comes from timber. In other words, Americans want those forests for recreation and all the things that they do, hunting, fishing, taking their families on hikes, visiting wild environments and so on, and they will pay a lot of money. And it doesn't make any sense to continue using the forest in a way that yields only a small fraction of the income they can yield, and short-term at that, and in a way that destroys the value that Americans are willing to pay the most for and put their lives or engage their lives with recreation. That's just one of numerous examples. Look at the numbers. Mm-hmm. Let's start rethinking a lot of this.
Well, I'd like to say I'm excited to have a chance to talk to a man who has brought so much wisdom to bear on these topics. And I'd like to take a step back and ask you, how were you inspired as a child to study nature?
I had an advantage that fewer and fewer kids have these days, and I'm very sorry for that. Namely, I lived a lot of my life in small towns, even in the southern city, it was called, really no, only a big town of Mobile, I could get out into the woods and explore on my own as a kid, streams and woods and places, hidden places, see nature, mess up nature a little bit, collect black widow spiders as I did, and frogs and butterflies. And I led to a substantial degree an unfettered childhood in nature. And although many might recoil at the idea, particularly those who feel that their children should be educated as fast as possible in the ways of the world, with all sorts of special training and education, language, music, appointments to participate in social affairs and so on, that this is the modern era, some might think, that needs a redirection of child's education. I say no. I say that's needed. But we need to allow children much more than has been the case, or is in recent years in this country, to the freedom to find their own way, to explore, and not to interfere with it. Keep them safe, but let them get into an environment where they are masters, where they are learners on their own, and they can find out that they can do things and learn things and feel things that no adult could ever transmit to them. No television program or no computer program, internet presentation can give them.
It's sort of, in the sense, tuning into a different frequency, as it were, when you step into nature and you can be part of that rhythm, and there just is no other substitute for putting your hands on something and really examining it.
Yeah, there's a sense I like to call kinesthetic. Kinesthetics refers to not touch, that's tactile, but kinesthetic is the use, particularly of your hands, in touching and manipulating objects. Well, we get some of that. Children do early on in handling machines and apparatus and so on. But in nature, they need a lot of kinesthetic experience. That is, not just seeing as you would on a NOVA program on television, but actually being there and some control of the situation where they can touch things, pick them up, capture them, look at them closely, build something in nature, like a little hideaway. A basic instinct of children is to find hideaways between the age of 9 and 12. That's been demonstrated pretty thoroughly as a trait of that age group. And go through a learning experience that entails a lot of handling and the feel of things when they're picked up, turned over, examined, and generally mastered in the senses through direct experience.
When you were teaching at Harvard, I know that you found it very important to teach just the regular students, not just necessarily biology masters and things. Did you find that they were bringing a strong curiosity to the subject, or were they really connected to their world?
They could be, and they were, many of them. Right here at Carnegie Mellon, just an hour or two ago, one of my former students came up to me and said, "I took your course at Harvard, and I'm now teaching environmental science at Chatham as a result of it." So that really makes life feel full for me. And yes, I deliberately taught non-concentrators. I did teach biology concentrators as well. Mm-hmm. But there you've got a captive audience of pre-meds. That's really what you've got. They've got to take that course. And you know they have to learn the things mm-hmm. that you tell them. And they've got to do it, pass exams, and get a good grade on it. And that's somehow, that's true for a lot, not all, but for a lot. That sort of kills the thing, doesn't it? That's sort of like a clinical approach to love.
Oh,
and so I chose instead to teach most of my career non-majors. And they are the ones that are taking that course. They've chosen it. Mm-hmm. Because they feel they may get something out of it. I didn't give many high grades, so it wasn't that. But they felt they could find maybe something new and interesting. And that kind of an audience is what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. You then can really instill in them a sense of wonder that's intensified by the fact that this is relatively new stuff to them. And furthermore, I like to teach it because I said to myself from start to finish, sitting before me, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, their hair is too long, their dress is inappropriate, they are tempted to read the Harvard Crimson while I'm lecturing, but there sit our future legislators, our newspaper editors, our business leaders. They are the ones I want to get to right now. And I've, of course, a lot of that type come out of Harvard, and I mm-hmm. got to them, and I feel that I did much more teaching that group than I would have teaching regular biology.
As you spent your life looking at something so small as an ant, and they've done such beautiful work on that, what larger conclusions have you been able to bring to your work in the world by having studied such a small thing?
That's too big a question for me to answer.
Well,
but I've written some pretty big books on it.
It is like a big book.
That's right. The ants and and the sociobiology and mm-hmm. The insect societies. And forthcoming next year is a book called The Superorganism.
Oh, okay.
But maybe I can answer it partly by saying that the social insects, ants, bees, wasps, termites, dominant elements in the environment. So you can learn a lot of ecology just by studying them alone. But what makes them really interesting is that they are one pinnacle of social evolution. The human species is the other high pinnacle. And by studying the social insects, which after all have nothing whatsoever in evolution to do with the human line, and their social orders are completely independent in origin, are like studying social life as it might evolve on another planet. In other words, it's a completely different experiment. And by comparing social insects Although vast differences and even a few similarities to human societies, you can learn far more about human society. Of course, I study them just for their own interest. But if someone says, well, what good does that do us? Well, I'll tell you right now, it tells us an awful lot about how the environment is run, but it also tells us an awful lot about ourselves.
It seems like we're learning a big part of that question now with the colony collapse disorder that's happening with bees. Is there some big lesson here that we should pay attention to?
Well, that's a very specialized problem. And I tell you, it teaches another lesson that's just as important. It doesn't tell us a lot about the social behavior, you know, the distinguished bees. But the collapse, bad as it has been, and it's causing, it probably will be causing into the billions of dollars, not just to beekeepers and honey producers, but to farmers and orchidists generally. The lesson is that humanity depends upon too few species of plants and animals. We have not utilized biological diversity that exists in great abundance. A religious person might say, we have ignored the bounty of the Lord. We depend almost entirely on 20 to 30 kinds of plants. And half our calories or more comes from just four grains, four species of whose seeds we eat. We are specialized seed eaters, and not seed eaters, just seeders, but grass seed, if you think about it, and just a couple of species, you know, wheat, corn, rice, and millet. And if we had just those four species disappear, the vast majority of people would starve to death. Well, we don't need to be in that precarious position. We've become so dependent on such a small number of species that a catastrophe hitting any one of them has a big effect. And since bees, honeybees, are our principal pollinators, and since 30% of our food calories come from plants that have to be pollinated, when the bees started going down, then people felt it pretty quickly, at least the farmers did, and those who generally depend on pollination done by insects. So that's the lesson there. We really have to broaden our base. It's another reason for studying and understanding biodiversity. The diversity of any kind is a source of strength, and we just haven't used it. We've been running along carelessly on a very limited part of the resources available to us.
One of the things I've really enjoyed about your work is the way that you've been a champion for biodiversity, but the way that you've been able to link it to another problem that we're facing in these times is global warming. And could you elaborate on that, why biodiversity and global warming are connected?
Yeah, that's an important question. It's become more obvious with each passing month that there's a tight link between global climate change. Let's call it climate change, because it's not just warming, it's changes in precipitation and patterns around the world. A link not just with a number of human affairs, but also with the condition of the living world. Because when you change climate, you're not only changing areas to the detriment, most of it to the detriment of the people who live there, who are adapted to that particular place they live very well, but also to vast numbers of species of plants and animals. In other words, a supporting base of our existence, the living ecosystems on which ultimately we depend, they are affected. And if we don't take measures that halt this or abate it, we're going to be losing large numbers of species due to and whole ecosystems, like is happening in the Arctic right now, through climate change. So then anyone interested in the rest of life, you know, in the biological diversity of life, the variety that we have today, and seeing it preserved, would be very nervous about climate change for that reason as well.
And how do we make biodiversity feel important for just the average person going through their daily lives? How do we make this sink in that this is essential to life on this earth?
Well, you know, stronger statements about it, true, but stronger than typically are made. People too much still think about the living world as external to them and to human affairs. You know, fuzzy little animals that are cute and ducks to shoot in the right season and things to show the kids on a summer jaunt. But nature is vastly more important to humanity than that. It's our support system. And it isn't long when you get into the reading and learning about it that you begin to understand that those natural systems are absolutely vital to maintain in the long term the ones we depend on. Yea, even to the agricultural systems that we've converted so much of the world into. We need them because of the services that they perform for us scot-free. Here's a figure to keep in mind. The amount of services, if given dollar value, from natural ecosystems, you know, like the woods you can see right out the window, or down farther, you know, the riverbank, and so on. The systems that live there produce, through their services, pollination, water purification, water maintenance and management. Remember the filtering effects and the holding effects of the watersheds that we're all beginning to wake up to now as being vitally important. The restoration of soil. You wouldn't get really good restoration of soil if without them. And so on. The total value of all of that has been roughly estimated by economists and biologists working together to equal the total human productivity. That is, the total gross world domestic product, the combined domestic products of all the countries in the world. Everything humanity produces, put it in dollar value, is equaled, roughly equal, by the ecosystem services given by these cute little animals and pretty flowering plants and, you know, the natural ecosystems of the world, scot-free. And that's the best deal we ever had as humanity. And by going and just destroying it is, from that viewpoint, just purely economic viewpoint of human welfare considerations, is crazy.
It's staggering how many beings on this earth we have no idea about. And you mentioned something in your remarks earlier about the Encyclopedia of Life. What is the Encyclopedia of Life?
It's a new project that was launched last May. It's sponsored by and being pressed now by leading institutions such as the Smithsonian, Harvard, Field Museum in Chicago, Missouri Botanical Garden, and so on, with increasing numbers joined in a consortium to put it across. That will create, is beginning to create. You can find it on the web under EOL.org, EOL.org, and find out about it. That is creating an encyclopedia which consists of one page for a species with everything known about that species, from its genetics to its place in the ecosystem, relevance to human welfare, and so on. Everything that's known about it is put on that extensible page. And all new information coming in is added for all of the 1.8 million species of organisms known to this point and all of the organisms that will be discovered in the future. And information technology now has advanced to the point where you can create that encyclopedia, and it is being created. It's also wonderful for being available from the start, all that information, by single access. That's EOL.org, by single access anywhere in the world, anytime, to anyone. And that is a dream coming true.
Very nice.
And that's really important. That means that biology is going to grow dramatically in that direction. And furthermore, that there will be a lot more public awareness, we trust, on biodiversity, what's that in that encyclopedia, especially when people find out that they can browse in it. When they take a trip, you want to go to Aruba? Oh, while you're there, why don't you study the birds of Aruba? You know, people on any subject having to do with life anywhere in the world can be researched and they can browse and find out about it. When that becomes more mature as a public service, which you know, it's just beginning now, but it will grow, then I believe people will be much more aware about the importance of biodiversity.
Well, Dr. Wilson, I'd like to ask you, why has this work been important for you?
Well, it's deeply satisfying. I mean, I love nature. I love doing natural history. I love being an explorer naturalist. I've been able to travel around good parts of the world and hunted in distant rainforests, never before visited, and generally played out all my boyhood dreams of being an explorer, and those dreams are still there to be had and to be realized by coming generations. That was satisfaction enough, but then when I came on to big issues of science, where I saw that you could really make significant discoveries by this kind of work, it became more satisfying, and I think I've produced some things of lasting value there. But most recently, to become aware, as I began really seriously 30 to 40 years ago, that the world's diversity of these systems that we want to have for this kind of exploration and study are vanishing. Then I realized that something had to be done, and whatever I've been able to accomplish personally in that direction is the legacy I'd care most about. When the curtain goes down and I get the chance to go to that great rainforest in the sky.
That'll be a great welcoming party, I would imagine.
Well, I hope so.
But we don't want to leave you too soon. So thank you so much for your time, and really appreciate your having a chance to talk with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasant visit.
Thank you.